Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Guest tonight is Laura Augustine. She's the author of an amazing book about trafficking. And I'm going to let her tell you about the title and a little bit about the subject matter. Welcome, Laura.
Oh, thank you, Veronica. It's been some years since I've seen you, but I remember having a good time with you in the past. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, we were debating, so we'll have to tell our listeners a little bit about that debate. But tell us about your book first.
Well, this book is the product of 15 years of living in Latin America and the Caribbean and wondering why people didn't seem to understand about what people are doing when they travel to other countries and end up selling sex or taking any other kind of job that lots of people don't want. And I just wondered why all these people in the U.S. and Europe were assuming that this was all a tragic story and that they were all victims. And so I ended up studying it and reading a million books, and then it turned out that my point of view was different from everyone else's. So I published the book.
The name of the book, by the way, is Sex at the Margins, Migration, Labor Markets, and the Rescue Industry.
That's right. And we had a little bit of a tussle at the publisher over what to call it, because it's not directly about the word trafficking. It's really about migration and why people in the first world don't understand about migration. And so a kind of subtopic of it was trafficking. So we came to a compromise by not having the word trafficking in the title, but having lots about it in the book.
And trafficking is, I think a lot of people are familiar with that term, but don't necessarily know even what it refers to, because we hear about it all the time in the news. It's in the papers and 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock news, you know, trafficking. What is trafficking?
Well, you know, people have a different idea about it, because the word has been around, for instance, in this country for a long time in connection with drugs. If I meet someone in a bar somewhere and they say, what do you do? And I try to tell them and I use the word trafficking, and they'll say, oh, you mean drug trafficking. That was always what it was called. So The word traffic is a way of talking about markets that's negative. Yeah. So instead of calling it buying and selling with licenses and permissions and going through customs, it's about movement of goods or people or whatever without those permissions. So it's a kind of crazy word. So it came from drugs and it just moved into organ trafficking and sex trafficking and everything else.
And doesn't the government, the United States government, have some big new laws that passed against trafficking?
Well, it's the United States government is, as usual, trying to be a protagonist in some kind of great moral crusade in the world, and this is an area that they took on. It's not a new law. It's actually been around for a while. The whole issue of trafficking laws has been around in Europe for much longer, but it became very popular here it's less than 10 years. But the difference, so everyone's doing the same thing, trying to decide what kind of travel is correct and incorrect, but the United States has the difference, the government, of making judgments about everyone else in the world, whether they have good laws or not, and issuing a report card every year, and generally taking an extremely moral tone toward everyone who is doing something wrong in their eyes.
This is very paternalistic, but that's pretty much the stance the U.S. tends to take with the rest of the world.
Right.
We know what's right, you don't.
That's right. And this is about sex, so it's about, we know what kind of sex is right.
Correct.
And good for the world. So the American kind of, whatever that is, sex is the right kind, and those relationships are the right ones, and that's the kind everyone should have. And so there's a great confidence in imposing that on the rest of the world.
There is, and as a sex worker rights activist, I'm familiar with something called PEPFAR, which is President Bush's attempt to police the rest of the world when it comes to prostitution. And there's an anti-prostitution pledge that anybody who wants to take federal funding from the United States for things like HIV prevention, AIDS work, anything where they're working with people's health, and they have to take a pledge that they are not in any way supporting the decriminalization or legalization of prostitution.
Right.
That all prostitution is, in fact, an act of rape.
That's right.
And doesn't that also come into play around the whole trafficking thing? Or?
Well, yes, of course it does. You use the word paternalistic in a way, although Bush is obviously, is a big player here. I talk about maternalism and about a kind of neo-colonial idea of feminism, so that what we have here is protagonist, second-wave feminists who have reached positions of power in the world, who are attempting to impose or get everyone to agree on a single definition of prostitution that will be negative. And so there's an alliance that's got the President of the United States and these feminists, and they are all over the world, these particular kind of feminists, and a lot of religious fundamentalists who want to impose this idea. If you impose the idea that all prostitution is, by definition, violence and rape and non-consensual, then you're justified in saying that anyone who travels across a border and sells sex has been coerced and forced and needs to be deported and go home.
Yes, and there's actually a measure before Congress right now, and I think it passed the Senate, and now it's before the House of Representatives,
yeah.
Or it could just be the reverse of that. Maybe it was passed the House and this is before the Senate. But I was just in Miami in May, and I was actually debating, having a public debate with a branch of government down there that was enforcing the anti-trafficking laws for Miami.
Right.
And the whole thing that this, the agent who had shown up was talking about how, well, we're only rescuing women who really want to be rescued and where there's, actual proof that they have been coerced or physically abused. And, of course, I wasn't sure I bought into that, but I asked him, do you know that Congress is trying to pass a law where it will no longer be required that you have to show any kind of force or any kind of coercion or any kind of defrauding, that by mere fact that somebody has crossed the border to commit an act of prostitution, they will be considered a trafficking victim. And he was totally unaware. Totally unaware. I was like, because, he had envisioned himself as kind of this guy with a gun and a badge who's out rescuing damsels in distress.
Yes. Well, that's what my focus in the book is about. My focus was not about the migrants so much as the people who want to save them, because there's actually been a lot of research and a lot of common sense stuff about why people sell sex at some point in their life and how it can be okay and how people can prefer it to other jobs. But there wasn't anybody looking at what all these people who think that they're in a completely benevolent situation are doing. And so that's what my research was really about. And I meet people like your guy in Miami quite often, because they've come into this. They don't actually know anything about prostitution. It hasn't been their life. It hasn't been anything that they specialized in before. But the U.S. government offers money for programs to help people. The law is about finding the criminals, putting them in jail, punishing them, and saving the people who need to be saved. And so you can get money if you write a proposal that says we're going to do this in Las Vegas or Miami, we will do it in this kind of a way, and it all sounds completely benevolent. And as long as you have only run into people who are truly miserable, then you can feel good about what you're doing. The problem is that there's then a misunderstanding about, well, what about all the other people that you're not running into, or what about when you run into someone who tells you an ambiguous story? That's what happens most of the time.
Right, and you were talking about second wave feminists, and that's how you and I met. Of course, we were debating Melissa Farley in Berkeley about Measure Q, which was measure to not decriminalize prostitution, but to make it a low priority for law enforcement. And
so
we have intimate knowledge of some of the rabid philosophies behind the second wave feminism, and a lot of it just seems to come out of the whole idea that an erect penis is in itself inherently an act of rape.
Yes.
Which was something that I think Andrea Dworkin was one of the first second wave feminists to kind of further that whole idea.
Well, it's an idea that the penis invades, that there's a hole, there's a passive hole, which is the vagina, and then this thing goes in like a weapon.
Yes.
So it's a very, visually, it's, you can see how they make, it's a very simplistic idea, but you can see where they got there. The rest of it about how everyone feels is completely nonsensical, but
It's amazing that you bring that up, because this is actually one of the things that I teach in my workshops, is the whole idea that as a sex worker, the first year that I worked in prostitution, I was basically had an antagonistic attitude towards men, and because I was coming out of second wave feminism, which would seem probably kind of odd to a lot of people. Oh, you're a second wave feminist, but you're going into prostitution. But it was actually pretty common. A lot of lesbian separatists. making a little spare cash. And the whole philosophy was like, I'm taking money from the man. And at some point I started studying sacred prostitution from this wonderful woman named Cozy Fabian.
Yes.
And she totally shifted my paradigm, because then it was like I didn't have this orifice. The vagina is not an orifice. It's actually a muscle. And when I started realizing that my vagina was a muscle, I realized that muscles have a unique capacity in the body of becoming more powerful the more you use them. And that shifted my whole consciousness around being female, and I no longer saw the penis as the enemy that was somehow or another going to degrade my value. And I started realizing that, no, the more sex I have, the more valuable and accomplished and practiced and experienced and wise I become. But it seems like second wave feminism has definitely taken over the governments of the world, even like the Swedish model where they're putting the clients in jail.
Yeah.
And that's all we ever hear about is the Swedish model, but nobody ever talks about New Zealand, which has decriminalized prostitution.
Well, people do talk. I mean, my life is kind of international. So I, in other countries, you do hear constantly about the other kinds of models for things, for prostitution, for legalization or different kinds of, it's all regulation, how you're going to regulate it once you take the crime out of it. But we're definitely living in some kind of moment when, don't forget, I mean, you and I were second wave feminists. So it's not inherent to that period to end up with this weird idea about violence. There were plenty of us that didn't end up with that kind of idea. And I actually think that the fact that people like you and I came to a different conclusion is what really riles someone like Melissa Farley. Because it's as though we have betrayed whatever second wave feminism was meant to be. There was an assumption that we were all talking about the same idea of womanhood and we would all go to the same place, but ever since the mid-80s, there have been violent disagreements. So you have to now recognize that there's many kinds of feminisms, and some of us are older and started in the 60s, but ended up thinking differently about it from the way that these particular women that I call fundamentalist feminists are looking at things. And I think the difference is that they are, a group of them is on a campaign. It is a campaign to win on a certain thing, which is a definition about prostitution. And they're very passionate about that. And so they will do a lot of stuff to try to get there that you and I probably wouldn't do.
It's often struck me that people who really get on board for this particular activism around, trying to treat all prostitution as violence towards women, there's a lot of unhealed pain that drives that. A lot of anger and a lot of hurt. And I noticed that the people who, when I go to the the meetings where we're trying to decriminalize prostitution, I see a lot more smiling and laughing.
Yeah.
It's often struck me that to actually have some compassion for the people who are, because they're very much focused on, you know, some incredibly vile things that have happened to them or to people that they're close to.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't ever want to invalidate their pain. I absolutely. But I like to think about it like marriage. You know, most people think of marriage as kind of a neutral. There's good marriages and bad marriages. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we very rarely accord that kind of thinking mm-hmm. to prostitution. In prostitution,
yeah.
It's all bad.
Well, this is the thing that I end up enraging them about when I talk about trafficking, because I'm basically talking about migration, people with only a few options and therefore preferring one over the other and taking their chances and being adventurous and some people getting in trouble. And so there being this enormous, we're talking about millions of people worldwide, and so obviously we have gigantic diversity, and it wouldn't be a good idea to generalize about a single experience. And I say, well, this is all a continuum, right? So you can focus on what the media usually looks at, which is the worst possible case that's over here at one end of the continuum, that's where the person didn't know anything that was going to happen and didn't want any of it, and it was a disaster. Yeah, so that happens. There's no question that happens. And then at the other end, you've got some fantasy of a perfectly free, probably white, probably privileged woman who chose everything that ever happened to her. I, in fact, don't even know if that exists, but let's say that it does a couple of times. But everyone else is in the middle, and it's much grayer and fuzzier, and people know some things and not the others, and chose some things and preferred others. And if that seems to me to be the useful way to look at this, and not to try to come to some kind of definition about what is this trafficked or sex work or prostitution experience for everyone. That's the difference between me and the campaigners. My position obviously doesn't work for campaigning. It's a position that asks people to think about it and listen to other people to hear what they say.
Well, it's too nuanced.
Mm.
You need to have a black and white message there if you want to market it.
Yes, I know. I know. It's quite interesting, though, how many people are interested in listening to fuzzy stuff. It turns out, after I published this book, that enormous numbers of people write to me and come to me and say, well, I knew it couldn't be that simple. I knew it couldn't be, but no one said it before. I don't quite know why, but no one said it.
So to give like a positive story to balance out all the negative stories that we've been hearing about trafficking, what would somebody migrating for the purposes of prostitution in an empowered or you know, less oppressed way, what would that look like?
Well, there's different things it can look like. Sometimes people know that they want to get out, they want to go someplace else because they're bored at home, or there's no options, or they've got an oppressive family or a violent boyfriend or whatever. For whatever reason, they know they want to go somewhere else, and they want to see the world, and they want to maybe find an Italian husband or see the Eiffel Tower or whatever it is. They're positive kind of ideas about traveling and making a new life. And a lot of this, as you can imagine, is a young person's point of view. Yeah, they're young and pretty and want to have an interesting life. And even if you're poor economically, you can be very rich in terms of your sexual capital or whatever you want to call it, right? You can have a beautiful body, you look young and adorable, and people like you, and it's very pleasant to be admired. And I think that this is not brought in very much, that it is a very pleasant experience to have people wanting to have sex with you and telling you that you're beautiful and that you look different. And so a lot of people who get into this situation migrate and maybe get into debt to migrate and have an odd idea about, well, what they'll be doing. And they might be surprised at the shape that the selling sex takes in the next place. But if they're lucky, then they are adaptable. And they realize that, well, I migrated. There's no way to migrate successfully unless you're willing to be flexible. And so you have to be flexible about what work you'll take and about what kind of place you'll live in and what food you will eat, and you have to be the kind of person that will learn other languages, and so you have to learn other sexual languages as well. And so it can be that someone adapts very well and is good at it. It has the right kinds of talents to do some form of sex work. For a lot of people, that's not very much sex and a lot of talking, a lot of conversation, and for other people, that's not much conversation and might be a lot of sex. But then they adapt to it and figure out how to make the money out of it and get rid of the debt. And whether they really, really like the sex or not, well, not necessarily. However, they may not find it so important that they have to love it or not. That's a very common story. Well, this wouldn't be my first choice. However, I got used to it. I know how to do it now. And I can make 10 times as much money as I can anywhere else, so then I'll go do something else later. And I would call that a very positive story.
It sounds kind of mundane. I'm like any other job. I mean, when I graduated from college and became an office manager, I was thrilled. It was a title I wanted, but I was kind of like, oh, I didn't know it was going to be like this.
Yeah.
So there's always an adjustment period. It's like, yeah,
exactly.
Okay. And then there's things you'll like about it and things you don't like about it.
Yes. Yes, so a lot of the rescuing things, the rescue projects run into trouble when, for instance, talk about nuanced, someone actually is unhappy about the job that they've got and they are in the country they're in illegally, and so technically they need to be saved. But what they would really like is to get out of the particular venue that they've got themselves into with some nasty boss or a place that doesn't give them enough money or a place that's in the wrong part of town. They want to get rescued from that, but then continue to do the sex work somewhere else in a better situation that they've heard about because now they have friends. They're in some kind of social network. And so that is obviously that's not the kind of rescuing that the benevolent social worker has in mind, right?
And is this why so many of the so-called rescued sex workers wind up going right back to the job they got rescued from or a job similar to the one they got rescued from?
Well, yes. It's also why people who are caught at the Mexico-U.S. border and get turned back over onto the Mexican side come back a million times. That you come back. I used to work on that border. You get thrown out. You got stopped by the Border Patrol at some place. That was bad luck. You got thrown back, and then you just try to take a different route the next time. So, yes, it's costly, it's unfair, it's stupid, and it can be violent. However, a person who has the idea of making their new life this way will go on trying. So the same is true. It's not different if what you're going to do is sell sex. There's no reason to think it's different. I think that's the crux of the whole problem about talking about this in public is that people imagine that, well, because if it's got sex in it, then it must be completely different from everything else, and you can't compare it to office management or picking strawberries or anything. But you can. If you're you or me, you can do it. You can say, well, I prefer to do blowjobs to picking strawberries because picking strawberries is bad for my back and I don't make enough money.
And absolutely, I can engage in that conversation specifically because my first job at 17 was picking strawberries.
Mm.
And it was. I would much rather give a blowjob than pick strawberries.
Yes. This is considered scandalous by a lot of people. And I was very surprised at the beginning when I realized that this was considered absolutely an unholy thing to say. And the thing is, you have to go back to the Andrea Dworkin, to the kind of philosophy about what sex is supposed to be, that it is supposed to be, according to some law, a highly meaningful experience between two people who love each other, who are everything is mutual and symmetrical and perfect, and there's no power differential, some amazing kind of definition that's being assumed.
Right, and then penetration becomes suspect because we're afraid that one actor has more power than the other one.
That's right. That's right.
And what's for me actually, I have had a lot of meaningful spiritual connection with clients, and I see a lot of people who've been married for 20, 30 years who aren't having anything meaningful or spiritual going on between them.
Yes, unfortunately, that seems to be very common.
Yes, it does. And I wonder when the human animal is going to evolve to the point where it can stop getting focused on titles and rituals and start actually absorbing the essence and the energy of a particular situation.
Yeah, no, I don't. I kind of despair of the thing about the thing about marriage. And even if it's not marriage, it's a civil union, it's a partnership, it's all perfectly fair. It's all, there's some idea that it's perfectly symmetrical. I never have had any friendship with anybody where I would have been able to say at all moments it's completely, the power is always exactly balanced. It seems insane.
When I teach a workshop for couples called A Garden Bursting with Life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a workshop where the couples, they get to come in and get naked and have sex with each other, not with the other couples. I don't make any connections. I don't, like, set up a dating situation for people. You have to come in with your own partner,
mm-hmm.
And you leave with your own partner, and your own partner is the only person you're going to touch or have sex with.
Mm-hmm.
But in this workshop, people are all excited because somebody's going to watch them have sex, and they're going to get to watch somebody else have sex.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're a little dismayed because the first hour or hour and a half, we're fully clothed, and we're working on relationship dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
And I will always ask couples, you know, tell me a little bit about your relationship, like, you know, who makes more money and who does more housework. And of course, without fail, the couples will always tell me, oh, we are absolutely equal. Everything.
Everything, uh-huh.
Everything. So the answer I get is always how everything's equal. But the reason that I need an hour or to an hour and a half is so that I can watch them interact with each other.
Yeah.
So that I can figure out who is dominating.
Yeah.
And it's not like who is dominating,
mm-hmm.
but who's dominating how.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because one person might dominate with the dialogue and the other one will dominate in some other way. And I just look for those dynamics in that hour and a half so that I can turn them on their head mm-hmm. for the next hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Because the whole idea for me about getting them to some of their, you know, to new sexual highs is for to be able to get them past the constraints of their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. but yes, almost everybody is so equal. It's not easy.
Yeah, it's almost disheartening, the idea that every single thing you would do in a sexual situation would have to be exact, like timed so that, okay, your turn, my turn, exactly, that there has to be some kind of symmetry of the bodies. I don't know exactly how they got themselves, the fundamentalists, into this corner where sex would have to be like that, because it can't be that even in their own lives it's like that. So it's very, but you can see how if you take that value, then anything that is men and women who don't know each other very well, which is a lot of the situations that I know about, people are traveling, they don't have profound relationships, so it couldn't possibly be equal. The idea that the person with the money and who speaks the language of the country that the migrant has come to and speaks it better, that there's some kind of idea that all the power is over here on this client, all of it. And you can't really, if you take it apart, you think, well, but even that doesn't work. There's a price. He has to agree to the price. I don't know. But that's the kind of myth that of the power that's going on, is some kind of enormous numbers of rich white men buying exotic dark women who have no power at all.
And don't you think there are some racial overtones in this whole trafficking, you know, hysteria?
Well, the racial thing that's certainly going on in terms of the rescue industry is that everyone in the third world is imagined to be dark and primitive and passive and unknowing. So it's an old-fashioned colonial idea that these are people who don't know their own minds, and especially if they're women, they should all be at home cooking and gathering berries or whatever anyone is thinking. It's a completely crazy idea about color and where you were born and stuff.
So they make perfect victims for the would-be rescuer.
That's right. That's right. In terms of a place like Europe, where there are large numbers of migrants not only women, men, boys, girls, everyone, of all different colors who are coming in who don't have permission to work in the European Union. So the trafficking thing doesn't have a color at the moment because all the Eastern European women that are being accused of being trafficked are beautiful white women. And then there are people from Nigeria, and then there are Thai people, and then there are Latin Americans. And so you get all these different kinds of colors, and it's all very unclear, therefore, whether we're talking about are trafficked people all black? No. No, that's clear, because it's all of these white people from Eastern Europe and the ex-Soviet Union that are being called trafficked at the moment. So the racial thing gets pretty confusing. If you go back and you stand here in the United States and you look at the thing about prostitution, it does look pretty racialized, so that all of the fear is about poor black women on the street, poor Mexican women who are darker being exploited by white men.
And you mentioned that they should all be home sewing, and it made me think of the Indian, and I'm talking about the Nation India,
mm-hmm.
Sex worker rights organization that had a big banner, and I don't remember the exact wording, but it was something about where they could stick those sewing machines.
Yeah.
they were very definitely saying, we would rather do sex work than sew. Thank you very much.
Yes. Well, I mean, so that's another thing. Maybe some people would like to be rescued from sex work, but only if whatever was offered in exchange was, first of all, it has to be permission to stay in the place that you wanted to travel to. See, that's the main thing. This is all really about migration, because if people could just travel, then maybe they wouldn't have ended up, in sex work, maybe they would have ended up doing some kind of sewing or something, if they had been free to just get a cheap ticket and go and take some low-paying job. So it gets all very mixed up here. The idea is, oh, well, what would you rather do? Well, it's not really a relevant question. First of all, I wanted to come to Paris, so that's where I want to be now. It's not about would I rather
relate
sew.
To that. I had actually entertained the, I never did this, but I entertained the idea of sexual tourism to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was very expensive to travel to Japan, and I'd always wanted to see Japan, and I had gotten wind that there were some very lucrative sexual jobs over there.
That's right.
And it was like, well, this would be a great way to travel and make money.
Yes, I know people who've done that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's nothing that says, by the way, that an educated white woman from the U.S. couldn't get into trouble going to Japan, couldn't be deceived some way.
And that was one of the reasons I didn't go.
Yeah,
I was talking to somebody who actually had done sexual tourism there, and it had been lucrative and pleasant enough for them, but apparently they were actually doing live sex acts, and that was illegal, and I was like, you know, I wouldn't really want to be doing something illegal in a foreign country.
Well, that's what my stuff is really about. It's really not about, since I have talked to hundreds and probably thousands of people by now who have said, no, I don't mind doing the sex part. Certainly, and I'm not the only one, there's at least 65 research projects that have been done in some kind of regular way all around the world that have talked to migrants who have ended up selling sex and who say more or less the same thing. Look, I don't mind doing this for now. I'm pretty good at it. I might prefer to be an office manager, but I'm doing this. It's fine. However, the illegality of the situation is what bothers everyone. So what everyone all over the world wants is the permission to be wherever they are legally.
Right.
Yeah, just to be able to, because if you're allowed to be there legally, then you might have some more options. Then you might say, well, I might continue to be a prostitute or not.
Right.
So if I do continue, then it'll be because I said I really want to, and now because I have other kinds of options. But when you're illegal or undocumented or unauthorized, which is it's a better kind of language to use about it, then you're slipping around in the informal economy, avoiding the cops, not denouncing anything bad that happens to you, limited ability to find out about other kinds of jobs, not able to approach employers directly to say, I'd like to pick strawberries or be an office manager.
You know, it seems to me, too, that if I were in a foreign country and I got arrested for paid sex, that it would be advantageous for me to say that I had been held against my will and that I didn't know what I had come to this country to do. I thought I was going to be a waitress, but instead I'm an escort. Is there any truth to that?
I think yes. I mean, I don't ever emphasize this because we don't have statistics, but it makes perfect sense. And yeah, you're not going to. Most people, most of the migrants that I know really don't want everyone to know what they were doing. They left home because it would cause them shame in their family or whatever it is. People go far away. And so you get caught. You're not going to explain how voluntary it all was and how you knew about it. It's an upsetting, shameful situation. So it is easier for a lot of people to just say, well, I didn't know. The problem is that to get visas based on not knowing and on a, if you claim to be trafficked, you do have to present evidence. So they, you know, you don't just get the visa by saying that you were a victim. You might get a place in the woman's shelter for a while, but you'd
But you're far more likely to get a visa than if you say, I knew that I was going to be a prostitute and I like being a prostitute, because that's an automatic deportation, isn't it?
Well, you know what? I don't know that they pay for the airplanes to deport everyone. See, that's the other thing. It would cost a fortune for any government to actually pay to send everyone back. But probably as a show, they do deport some people. I think in this country, no one is going to admit it at all, because in this country, the United States, it's a crime to be a prostitute, so no one's going to say it. In the countries that of Europe, it's not a crime. It's not a crime to be the prostitute, so that's not the problem. But the issue of being caught without proper papers in the country, if you're Romanian and you end up in Portugal or whatever it is, then you haven't got permission to work, or you didn't. Now you do, because they've all joined. But there are countries, take the Ukraine. Okay, the Ukraine is not part of the European Union. If a Ukrainian ends up working at anything and getting caught in France, then there will be a question, what are you doing here? You're not allowed. So then they will be told to go away, or a file will be opened on them. So the situation in this country is more egregious in those terms. So I don't think anyone would admit that they knew they were going to be a prostitute.
And isn't it, in the United States, isn't they will, well, will they deport you or just put you in jail? What will they do?
I don't know. As I say, I don't, I think that they probably are just defining, if you're found by the cops, let's see, the cops would determine your status. There's a problem in that the INS, they're like the Border Patrol people, get involved. The Border Patrol people come in and say, we take priority, you can be deported. Whether the government actually pays for all those plane tickets is what I don't know, because that's expensive. That's expensive. And I know they don't do it from other countries, but they could make life. They can tell you have to be out in 3 months or you could go to jail.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know it's illegal in this country. They won't admit you if you're a so-called known prostitute.
That's right.
Then you're not allowed to come into the country.
That's right.
So if your whole life's dream is being a U.S. citizen or living and working in this country, I would think admitting to willingly and knowingly going into prostitution would be the last thing you'd want to do.
Yes. I don't think so. In a country like Italy has an piece of legislation called Article 18, which says that if sex workers who have been picked up can prove that they have really been trafficked, they can enter a program that offers them whatever they want and things that they don't want, like learning Italian and knowing about Italian life and how to get over psychological damage or whatever it is, and ultimately to become an Italian citizen. However, very few people have really been able to get the citizenship that way because it's a legal issue to prove. You have to prove your case just the same way asylum seekers do. So you can say, okay, so I was trafficked by so-and-so in Albania, and
right.
he was mean to me. But they have to be able to find out that so-and-so was really there in Albania. They have to be able, the case has to be proved.
Well, I can understand that. Otherwise, everybody would be.
Exactly.
That sounds like
exactly.
a pretty rosy
That's true. Deal. I mean, that's obviously true, yes.
Teach me Italian, man.
That's right. So it's really, the way this is very dysfunctional. The whole thing is spending enormous amounts of money and not really getting anywhere. None of it's really getting anywhere, except morally there's all this screaming going on. But there's not a solution that's been come up with yet at all.
Well, one of the things, that, you know, the measure that I was talking about that's before the U.S. Congress right now about getting rid of the need to prove that trafficking victims, quote unquote, are actually victims, that we're now they're just going to be victims because we say they are, if this law passes. It's also bringing back some aspects of the old Mann Act, which I think was brought about in the early 1900s, and, which was really about so-called white slavery. And are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Yeah, so it. Do you have anything to say about some of the hysteria that this seems to bring up in people, the whole idea that our sweet, innocent women are being defiled by these big, bad people?
Yeah, well, this is, you know, there was a big, before the Mann Act in late 19th century Europe, that's where the term white slavery actually came about, and it was for a very similar reason to now. It was because less privileged European women, Jewish women, non-Jewish women, but Jewish women were kind of famous at the time, but women who didn't have lots of choices and decided to immigrate, and so they went to places like Argentina or Australia or whatever, and they did it, a lot of them did it off their own bat. They, in a similar kind of way, they might have had to borrow the money, they might have known what how few things there would be to do at the other end, but they did it. And when the news about this came out, it was obviously unacceptable. It was unacceptable to mainstream European societies that white women would do this, would actually go. It was known then that in Buenos Aires was filled with white women dancing with guys in cheap brothels and making money and dancing the tango and whatever it was. So these stories came back and they were considered horrifying, and the only way that it could be acceptable was to imagine that they all had been coerced. And, by the way, there were some pretty nasty gangs operating, just as there are now, trying to recruit people and not telling them the truth and all of that. So you got this tremendous mixture. But that was definitely a racial thing. The idea that those single women on their own would be getting on boats to go to other countries to do God knows what, that was very upsetting. So the only way to make it okay was to consider it that they were enslaved. And I think the Mann Act grew out of that. I think it's maybe 1913, something like that. And the Mann Act in this country has something to do with state borders as well. And it was, but isn't it about age? Wasn't that if someone under 18 or 21 was taken across a state border, that would be a crime?
Yes, I think so.
Mm.
And that's really what they're trying to get here is that, you know, they want trafficking to be about going past the state borders.
Mm.
So that, you know, all you have to do, and I think that was part of what they were trying to hit the D.C. madam, you know, Deborah Jean Palfrey with.
Mm-hmm.
Was the whole idea that she lived in California, but her escorts were working out of Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
So this becomes a trafficking issue because they're not in the same state.
I find this quite hilarious that in this day and age when people talk about globalization all the time and everyone's on the Internet and telephones will take you anywhere and you can get an airplane to any place in the world fairly cheaply, at the drop of a hat, that anybody should be worrying about whether someone goes from Iowa to Florida.
Yes.
As though that was like you belong. You were, but why should, if you were born in one place, what does that have to do with anything anymore? It doesn't have anything to do with anything.
And what is the whole idea that it seems to me like that, you know, this is supposed to be a feminist endeavor here, but really, it's so not feminist. The idea that women cannot travel freely.
I know. It's incredibly old-fashioned. It's incredibly old-fashioned and maternalistic, and I don't get the thing about the geography either. It's not long ago, it was considered so wonderful that people could get on a Greyhound bus, and in just a couple of days, they would be in another state, and they could get a new job and get away from their parents and whatever it was. That was a great thing. And so when did this become so? Now you have endless airplanes going over. Why should this be so horrifying? There's something very, very old-fashioned about in the fundamentalist rap about this, about where everyone's supposed to be.
Well, I mean, I do find, and I love your term maternalistic, by the way. It's the first time I've ever heard that.
Oh, good.
The idea that I need a mother, huh?
Yes.
To look after me and tell me what's right and what's wrong.
Yes.
Because I cannot be trusted with my own sexuality.
Yes, well, I think we saw that pretty clearly at that event in Berkeley, where the one side of the room had a tone of, we are the serious women who know how everyone else should live, referring to our side of the room as either dizzy, confused, lying, hypocritical, whatever. There's a definite
or out and out pimps.
Yes, or pimps.
Or
yes.
Somehow
or
another, we have a whole bunch of money and power. I always thought that was so comical because most of the sexual rights activists that I know have spent so much time volunteering in something that they believe in passionately, and they are like living from hand to mouth, and sometimes even homeless.
Yes.
And meanwhile, people like Norma Hodling and Melissa Farley are getting millions of dollars from, well, maybe it's not millions, but hundreds of thousands of dollars from the government to have things like John's School
Yes, I know, but they, you know, they would say that it's not for them personally, that they are saving people with it. And I don't want to argue with the idea that they do make some unhappy people happier sometime.
Oh, absolutely.
But the idea.
I used to be a volunteer for a center against rape and domestic violence.
Uh huh.
And wouldn't it have been horrible if our operation had entailed busting down the doors of happily married couples and rescuing the wives?
Yes.
Because all marriage is domestic violence. And you know what?
Yeah.
There's been times in my feminism when I could have gone in that direction.
No, I know. I see the point that they are making. What I don't understand, I'm talking about some kind of idea of feminism that's very fundamentalist, that assumes that there's one essential female experience, that we can know what some essential woman is, whether she is from India or Ghana or the United States. That idea, I can see why they feel that way, but I don't yet see why they need to impose it on the rest of the world.
That's taking the next step.
Mm.
It's one thing if you want to believe that your religion's the one right religion and everybody else has got their head up there, you know what?
Yeah.
I guess it's a free country and you can have that belief.
Mm-hmm.
But thank God you can't go around threatening people with incarceration or deportation unless they bow down to your particular God.
Yes.
And that's one thing that is really missing from this whole dialogue is the idea of rescuing women does really a horrible violence towards women. It takes away their dignity as adults.
Yes. Well, you know, I know a Bangladeshi feminist who someone paid for her to go to Washington and testify in front of one of these committees, was probably making the bill that you're talking about. And what she said to them was, I have been rescued 3 times. I would like to request that you leave me alone and let me get along with my life.
Yeah.
Yeah? So that whatever situation she was in was repeatedly targeted. And so she knew what being rescued had to offer.
Yeah.
And had decided that I'm not getting a good deal. This isn't for me.
Yeah.
she wasn't saying don't rescue anyone in the world, but like the situation that you focused on is dysfunctional. This is not, I don't want this rescue. So it's a whole idea of whether you will listen to other people who say, leave me alone. Leave me
right,
alone.
Right. I don't want to be rescued. Thank you very much.
Yes.
And what about the, didn't they have like these super inflated statistics, like there were going to be 50,000 trafficking victims in the United States, and apparently they've been trying to rescue them since 2000, and as of September of 2007, they'd only found a little over 1,300.
Yeah. The whole thing about the statistics is it's completely insane. The problem is that there's no worldwide accepted definition of what trafficking is because of all the things that we've said, because people interpret other people's situations differently. So there's no way to know whether an individual has actually suffered and wants to be saved or not. What the United States has done is, it's actually used agencies like the CIA to make estimates, to go talk to a few people in countries and make estimates, and they mainly talk to a few rescue projects and a lot of police, and they make up numbers. These are all made up numbers. It's all fantasy. I also can't give opposing statistics that would show how many free people who are choosing doing this or that. It's impossible because this is all happening in an informal economy in which people don't have permissions, visas, work permits, so you're not being registered anywhere. So this is all fantasy. Those particularly the statistics that the U.S. issues in that trafficking in persons report, which is the report card for the rest of the world, those are totally dodgy. There is nothing in that report that explains how they got those data. And we know that different countries in the world do not use the word trafficking the same way. It doesn't translate into all languages the same way. It's pretty chaotic what's going on out there about those statistics.
Right. So for people to come out with these sweeping statements that they know that there's all this number of trafficking victims, and then they can't tell you where they got those statistics, it's probably just a ploy to get more federal funding, don't you think?
Yes. Yes, well, and I think the higher level of the, you know, whatever's going on is the government attempting to assume the moral high ground for the rest of the world. So the Trafficking in Persons Report, which comes out annually and came out this June, rates everyone else in the world. It makes tiers and says, okay, these countries are our friends because they're good, and then these countries, we're on the watch for them because they're bad, and then these are the really, really horrible ones, and doesn't say anything about the situation in the U.S. itself. Yeah, so that offends all these other countries, because who needs a report card from the United States, right? So what they do is they pretend that they have inside knowledge about everyone else's country. But they've done it through embassies and CIAs and police, and they haven't talked to lots of people who would like to be talked to in those countries.
Well, it just seems to me that it always goes back to the idea that somehow or another, letting women run their own lives, including their own sex lives, is incredibly dangerous.
Yes, it's still considered very symbolic. Very symbolic. But your point about the girls going across the borders, it's very, very old-fashioned. I don't quite know how they can put that over in these days, but it still obviously has some power.
Oh, it does. It does. So how can our listeners find out more about you and your book, if they want to get a copy of your book?
Well, you can order the book from Palgrave Macmillan. You can order the book from Amazon. You can, I'm changing my own website to a blog, which is going to be pinged all over the place, in which I say these scandalous things about trafficking. If you just Google my name, it will come into my website, where there's enormous amounts of things that I've written that are for free to download. I think it's pretty easy to find the information and to keep up on this.
Do you want to give us the name of your book again?
It's Sex at the Margins, Migration, Labor, Markets, and the Rescue Industry.
And the publisher is?
Zed Books, which is in London. And so Zed, that's Z-E-D, Books. And it's distributed by the New York publishing company, Palgrave Macmillan.
Ah, wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
Nice to go through those major Eastern publishers. I know. So, I guess we'll wrap up now, my dear.
Okay, thank
All
you.
Right.
It's been wonderful talking to you.
Oh, thank you so much. I hope we can have you on again.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Veronica Monet offers help, healing, and hope in the form of private telephone sessions. Email veronica@sexwithoutshame.com to schedule an appointment, or visit www.sexwithoutshame.com to find out what Veronica can do for you.